morning. As many in Hawaii continue to spotlight areas to be preserved, how do those issues resonate with others around the world in similar struggles? We'll get a First Nations perspective on generational World Heritage Sites. And in advance of tomorrow's Honolulu City Council vote on a resolution to allow affordable housing trade-offs for a new condo tower, Appleseed Law Center's Victor Gianmagnani offers a counter-argument. And we'll check in with Neil Conan from The Farm. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Bill Sage. Spending a year in the high seas sounds like a 19th century adventure, but this is serious preparation for a 21st century year on Mars. NASA High Seas Forum crewman Tristan Bassingthwaite joins us to explain.
That's the conversation for this Tuesday, September 6th. Now the news.
Good morning. It's a beautiful Tuesday in the 50th state, and the IUCN continues. And Beth Ann, on this fine morning, it seems like we can run the gamut from Papahanaumokuakea to Pimachiwinaki.
Well, that would be true. That would be true. In fact, we're going to talk a lot about that for our first conversation. Now, as you mentioned, the World Conservation Congress is continuing, but it's shifting gears this week. And we're continuing to talk with people from around the world confronting many of the same or similar issues as face Hawaii. Today, we look at a First Peoples response to preserving areas of cultural and environmental significance, and in particular, an area where activists are trying to get over 33,000 kilometers of boreal forests and traditional territory of several First Nations acknowledged as a World Heritage Site in Manitoba. That didn't happen this summer, but the activists, including Sophia Roblauskas, continue to press for the designation for Pimachiwinaki. Sophia joins us now. She's a member of the Poplar River First Nation in Manitoba, Canada, and we're glad to see you. Thank you for making time in the middle of all of your activity.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening with those 33,000 square kilometers in Manitoba. You've been pressing for, what, 15 years to get that designated, and during this last summer, in the last effort, it was referred, meaning it's going to wait another year. Why did you decide, you and the other activists, decide to accept the referral?
Well, we put in a lot of time and effort and, you know, getting this nomination in, and it has taken that many years to do, and, you know, and it's right. It seems right to just continue because it's something that the communities have worked hard to do and hope for. So, yeah, it's it will be continued.
It almost seems as if you're saying that you were going to keep pressing on this wall until we knock it down.
Yes. You know, it's something that we feel that will help us continue to protect and preserve our land, our language, our way of life. So it's something that we strongly believe in, and hopefully that, you know, another year will help us achieve that.
And in the great scope of things, may not be all that much time to have to wait, given the effort that's gone into it. Why is this land so significant? And is there, you know, a difference in your mind between when we sort of talk about environmentally important and culturally important?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important because it's part of who we are. I remember my my father telling me the importance of the land and how it's sacred to our people. And if we don't protect that environment, that his, you know, the teachings, it's alive. And, you know, the land provides knowledge and wisdom to our people. And if we don't take care of it, which means like protecting it from any industrial development, we will die as people and as community. And that responsibility is very, you know, I took that to my heart, that it is true. Because we have seen changes happening in our community, And in order to sort of bring that balance back to our community, we need to do the work that needs to be done to restore that balance in our community. And we do need that land very much so today. We're at the critical point in our lives where we really need to go back to the land and heal our community and our people and even our nation.
You were a very young person when your father gave you that message. How are young people now hearing the message that you're trying to pass on to them about the importance of this land?
I think through revitalization of our teachings, our culture, because at one point we were at the brink of losing our language, and a lot of the language is important to us because those teachings in the language talks about the respect of the land and you know it's important that we do that now and continue to do that, and for the children and the youth to be involved in this process.
There are people listening to what you're saying now and likely thinking, that sounds a great deal like what we hear from Native Hawaiians in Hawaii. And what is the place of Hawaiians in Hawaii now? And how will land be protected or not protected? As you've been here now only for a short while, you told me before we went on here that you've been making connections with a lot of people here locally. And almost amazed that those connections were so strong. Why?
Because they have similar stories. They have we have commonalities. You know, you start talking, you start listening to people, and you sense that that same struggles that we have as Indigenous people. And that's one of the things I do when I travel to different countries. You know, I try to connect with the local people. Local Indigenous people who have lived on those lands, and try to hear their stories about the land and the life they live and the struggles that they continue. And I've seen, it doesn't take long for these connections to happen. And you know, you try to create opportunities to remain connected. I often say, you know, those stories are what makes us who we are as Indigenous people, our strong connections to the land, to the sea, you know, to everything around us. And it's so similar. There is nothing different. It's just where we live that, I guess, is a bit different.
How do you draw strength from all of what you have heard and be able to maintain those connections and strength to be able to help you carry forward?
My belief in the Creator. I think the Creator gave us this teachings and the laws to protect our way of life and even our forest, you know, where the Creator put us to live and to take care of it. And those are the teachings of the elders, is to acknowledge that, to acknowledge the spirituality of the land, the water, the sky, everything that's around you. And that's where my strength comes from. When I made the connection to that land, you know, my perception changed so drastically that I wanted to continue to do that work.
And Sophia, the connections that you've made, you know, worldwide, as you talk to many Indigenous peoples fighting many of the same good fights in their minds that must be fought, that will continue to be fought, as you have said you will continue. How do you take those stories and be able to bond together to create, you know, a movement?
I do a lot of praying. And when I meet people and the struggles, you know, I always include them in my prayers. I always, support whatever it's done with.
But do you stay in connection with, contact with everyone to be able to maintain that connection?
I do. I try to, you know, because now our social media gives us that opportunity to stay connected, you know, through through, you know, with technology. And I think that's one good thing that I see about this technology. It keeps us connected and keep updated on things that people are working on.
Well, we hope those connections stay fast for you. And thank you so much for coming in to talk to us a little bit about what's going up in Manitoba.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sophia Roboskis is an environmental activist and a member of the Poplar River First Nation in Manitoba, Canada. She was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize in 2007 for her efforts to secure protection of undisturbed forests in the boreal region of Manitoba. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, life on Mars, sorta. But first, your backyard quiz.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're looking at a man born in the Kingdom of Hawaii who served as mentor to one of the most influential Americans of the 19th and 20th centuries. That influential American was Booker T. Washington, the educator, activist, and presidential advisor who was born a slave. Our mystery mentor was born in Wailuku, Maui, to missionary parents in 1839. In adulthood, he went on to gain a commission in the Union Army and commanded an African-American regiment during the American Civil War. He eventually started a school in Virginia, which is where he would meet a young Booker T. Washington. Today, we're looking for that mentor's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Imagine you're living in a house with several roommates, and it's one of those long weekends where you're all starting to get on each other's nerves a little. Now, imagine that long weekend's 365 days, and you can't leave the house because it's on Mars. Getting along well becomes a highly desirable ability, that and staying alive in a rather hostile alien environment. Such are some of the issues faced in NASA's High Seas Project, which stands for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. And Tristan Bassingthwaite just spent a year in the fourth iteration of the High Seas program, and he joins us in studio. Aloha, Tristan.
Aloha.
So, how'd you get along?
Oh, very well. Most of the time, you guys have, things we're doing together, geotasks, research, that sort of thing. Personal time, you can go outside in the suits if you've requested it beforehand. Personal projects, a lot of us learn to cook or dance or do exercise, so always something to do.
So it's a co-ed crew of six?
Yeah, three guys, three girls. We've each got extraordinarily small rooms at the top of the dome, and most of the day is spent working or just running around trying to get science done.
When you have all the projects going together, because this essentially is going to be as close as possible to the simulation of what it's really going to be like when it happens, fingers crossed and rockets working and everything else. So the 8,200-foot level of Mauna Loa is pretty close in terms of, I imagine, how they're going to pressurize the habitat on Mars. It's about the same atmosphere?
Give or take. It's more up there just to get away from everybody. Mm-hmm. And then the actual habitat, due to Mars having about one bar of pressure, will be pressurized to something high up, sort of like an airplane is a much higher pressure just to keep your dome or everything from popping. You don't want to fill it with too much air.
That's the truth. Do you guys, I imagine most of you have seen the movie The Martian.
Oh, yeah. After it came out and actually got on DVD, one of the resupply drops brought it up and we got to watch it. So that was a lot of fun.
So what do you think the actual mechanics that you're working on? You're in architecture.
Yeah.
So you're there watching how everybody's interrelating and how can I better improve the interior?
Exactly. Seeing how people get along with the social component, being in such a small space together. There's also the isolation and what that does to people. We don't get to see anyone for the entire year. Our extreme environment was the lava fields. So it was interesting if you're a geologist, but it's still very barren. Actually, on Mars, you're going to have solar radiation, a lack of atmosphere. The skies won't even be blue, so it'll be even more psychologically stressful. So I'm actually trying to design to make that much more bearable through, say, artificial weather, virtual reality, materials, interior programming, how to make a home away from home as small as possible, essentially.
So when you're doing all this stuff in your mind, what do you... You're sitting there. You got the space. This is what they think is good. Hmm. So everybody is kicking in on how can you improve it. Hey, Tristan, you're the architect. What can you do to make it better?
Oh, yeah. And there's some of the things I could have done to change things. Soundproofing could have been nicer. definitely. Just even when you're trying to sleep, you can hear somebody walking in the other end of the habitat. Private spaces can be much more important than you might guess when you actually can't get away from people. So changing the programming so there's maybe a couple little nooks where you could hide and read a book. Anything you can do to sort of give people a sense of space. If I can't see somebody, I can pretend they're farther away.
Do you go ahead and actually simulate the lag in communication time from the distance to Earth? So if you communicate, they build in the delay time?
Oh, yeah. It's built into all email, all communications. We have virtually no internet whatsoever, just access to Wikipedia, since you can download the entire site and upload it wherever you'd like. Mm-hmm. And in a sort of quasi-emergency, you could get onto, like, banking or something like that. But essentially, the whole of humanity is at least 20 minutes out and 20 minutes back.
So that length of time really brings home the reality. Did you ever reach the point psychologically where it's not a simulation?
There's some points where you can see the wind rippling over the habitat. You look out and Mauna Kea is right there. You can see the satellites. Like, you're very aware you are on Earth, if mm-hmm. only because the gravity is Earth gravity.
Yeah.
But you still have the overwhelming sort of isolation, confinement. You can't go outside ever unless you've actually requested an EVA with suits. So the psychological stressors and how you actually behave on mission is extremely accurate, even if the environment has to have, just because we're here, some changes.
What sort of pre-screening for personality evaluations go through for candidates?
You've got the sort of online general screening to make sure the basics of sound mind and body can actually get mm-hmm. along to an extent with others. Probably anything you might have for a government job, for example.
I notice I did not ask the very first question on a lot of people's minds. Mm. I'll just put it this way. So NASA's policy is still don't ask, don't tell?
Yeah, pretty much.
We'll leave it at that for that particular iteration of the program. But how about you individually and the members that are in the experiments? Are you actually candidates for Mars missions?
It can depend. I actually can't apply for NASA as my degree is design-related, not a STEM field. Mm-hmm. Other people who have done, say, medicine, engineering, mathematics, that sort of thing, you actually could get in for, say, payload specialist, that sort of thing. So eventually, yeah, maybe.
What sort of dates are we looking at as a possible start for the entire adventure?
Really, it depends on funding and proving a few pretty close technologies.
For example, I mean, so much of the original NASA that we worked with, it was the government did everything, and now it's going into a lot of private enterprise. Do you see any evidence where it's going to be more private than governmental?
Yeah, I remember reading, and do not remember the source, about NASA claiming the next space station will be privately built, and then they'll rent out space on it. SpaceX's reusable rockets have already brought the cost of sending things incredibly lower. Bigelow Aerospace has inflatable habitats that are being tested right now on ISS. 10 years from now, most of space travel will probably be private sector.
Is there any way, for example, a fairly practical defense, I guess, would be You know, with Mars's 1 millibar atmosphere, there's not a lot of slowdown for meteor strikes. And are there thoughts of hardening domes in space or using available technology?
The interesting thing with the inflatable modules is due to the tensile strength of the fabric and Kevlar and everything, they're actually twice as strong as our normal hard-shelled modules. You could shoot them with a gun and nothing would happen. They're like concrete.
So the muscle velocity, what forces mv squared, as I recall. So it's important to... Okay, well, let's see. That bullet was moving at about 600 miles per hour. That was moving at about 18,000. What do we do here?
On Mars, the actual atmosphere is extremely thin, but moving at those speeds, it feels extraordinarily heavy. It will take care of virtually any sort of particle from space or rock. Something big could obviously get through, and hopefully you're in a skylight or lava tube for that. But generally, the thing you're worried about is radiation.
Okay, well, as we say, y'all be careful out there. And Tristan, it's been a delight talking to you. This is an example of the time-space discontinuum, because this 7 minutes flew by in about a subjective 7 seconds. So I think I'd get along with you in studio.
Thank you.
Glad to see you. Best of luck in whatever you do in architecture, and we hope to see you again soon. Tristan Bassingthwaite is an architectural PhD candidate at UH Manoa, holds a master's in architecture from Shanghai's Tongji University, and is working on the next generation Mars habitat concepts. See our first Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more details. Is there life on Mars?
And now back to Earth. Hawaii prison contractor was a Hawaii prison contractor was convicted of fraud and bribery, but that hasn't stopped the potential award of a $1.3 million contract to design and rebuild OCCC from going to a New Jersey company. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So who is this contractor, and what resulted in these fraud and bribery convictions?
Well, let me give you a little backstory. Louis Kinea spoke to a woman on Maui, a prison reform advocate, and a couple of years back she got an email from this company. The company's name is Louis Berger. It is from New Jersey, as you say. And yes, the email had to do with trying to get support for replacing OCCC here on Oahu, which, as we know, is a crumbling jail, a lot of problems. Well, this Maui woman started to check out exactly who this company was and found out there were a lot of legal troubles stemming from corrupt practices. Let me just tell you two of them that were pretty outstanding. In 2010, this company, Louis Berger, overcharged the United States government for work that it did in Iraq and Afghanistan, like $10 million overcharged. Two of the executives pleaded guilty for defrauding the government. And one other case, in 2015, the World Bank debarred this company for a year for doing any practices because of corruption connected to Louis Berger. And yet, this is the very same subcontractor that was hired by Architects Hawaii, obviously a local firm, to work on possibly rebuilding, removing OCCC.
You know, people hear that story and think that's, you know, astounding. But the real issue is, was this subcontractor even vetted, or was only the primary contractor vetted?
It does not appear there was really any vetting at all done from the Department of Public Safety, which oversees the prisons, the Department of Accounting and General Services, which, of course, is administering contracts. At least one state lawmaker said, look, maybe we do need to have greater oversight of subcontractors. Mind you, it's the contractors that get the big contract, right? $5 million in this case to design and relocate OCCC, but not much vetting looking at the subcontractors. In fact, they have a lot to do with it. By the way, we didn't hear back from Architects Hawaii about why they hired this particular company. DAGS didn't elaborate very much, nor did the company itself really respond. And that's kind of frustrating. I know Kat Brady, who you know well, also someone who's a prison reform advocate, saying this is very troubling that the state of Hawaii is in the habit of hiring a company with a criminal record defrauding the government to work on our own prison system.
And that's, you know, part of the issue, though, that we've seen in other cases where sort of, you know, the first level of contracting is looked at. And we had the same thing with rail. Mm. You know, where's all the rail money when we subcontractors? Really bringing up the point of, do we truly need to look more deeply, not just at who we're hiring as the contractor, but who those subs are. And yet that's a tremendous amount of work to make all of that happen, too.
Right. But I think that is the reality check. And again, just to underscore this, this is our money. This is state taxpayer money going to companies with questionable practices, working on, of all things, building a new jail.
And with the past history, who could potentially be defrauding us. Okay.
Yes.
That's the reality check. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day for a reality check from Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
And now on to a perennial local issue, Hawaii's housing shortage. It's one that on Oahu, transit-oriented development is supposed to help solve. But a Honolulu City Council resolution that would allow a 36-story condominium hotel in the Hawaii Convention Center neighborhood has some community leaders wondering who exactly the project will serve. The resolution is on tomorrow's agenda, and it would allow several trade-offs, including the payment of a $2.4 million in lieu fee to satisfy the affordable housing requirement. And that's part of what's wrong with Resolution 16-172, according to Gavin Thornton, the co-executive director of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. Gavin Thornton joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The baseline question that you seem to be asking is really, is this giving the community a fair shake, given what we thought transit-oriented development was going to be all about? Is that the question you're asking?
That's right. One of the key goals of transit-oriented development was to ensure that we build affordable housing near the rail line to allow local residents to access rail and have an affordable place to live, and have work opportunities opened up to them through cheap transit.
Given the fact that it's possible for a project to pay a fee instead of meeting those affordable housing requirements, is there something wrong with the way this whole deal has been structured?
Well, that is that's the question we're asking. We're really trying to figure out right now whether this is a fair deal for our community. There are a couple significant issues. One is the use of cash in lieu of building affordable housing. Now, cash in lieu, cash does not mean a housing unit for a family. And so the ideal is actually to get housing units built in the rail corridor. And that's not what's happening here with the cash in lieu deal. The other thing is that this deal provides a lot of incentives to the developer that would ordinarily be used to encourage the development of additional affordable housing units. But here the amount being paid for affordable housing seems to be minimal relative to the benefits the developer will be receiving.
When you're asking that question about whether these offsets are really driving more affordable housing or simply giving developers a way out, it still comes back to the fact that this is possible in the first place, which goes back to the structure of how these deals can happen. That seems to be where most of the problem lies, not necessarily with this particular project. Would you agree with that?
I do agree. I don't think that the developer in this case has necessarily done anything wrong. But it is not, right now, it doesn't appear to be leading to the goals that everybody had in mind with transit-oriented development. We really need to be ensuring that these incentives that we can provide as a community to developers to build affordable housing are actually being used for that purpose, and then not being squandered. And that's the real issue here.
And shouldn't that be what the city council is really dealing with?
Yes, and so that's what we're asking for tomorrow. Tomorrow they're holding a decision-making on the permit for this development. We're asking them to take a step back and really evaluate closely whether this is a fair deal for our community, whether we're getting the most out of those incentives that the development is being provided.
Gavin Thornton, this is not the first time, though, that they've seen this resolution. It's already moved through. How, at this point, do you expect them to take that step back when they seem to be pushing this forward?
So last week it was passed through the Zoning Commission. And our organization, Hawaii Appleseed, wasn't aware of it at the time. And in fact, I think very few people in the community were. Now that folks are aware of it, are paying closer attention, we're really hoping that that folks at the city council level will pay attention as well. You know, one of the problems with this is these deals are very complex, and I think very hard for people to understand. And when you don't have advocates on one side trying to shine the light and simplify things so they're understandable, then things can really, you know, kind of fall through the cracks, move forward without the appropriate level of thought being given to them. So that's what we're asking for now.
Most developers want to make a profit on what they build, and that's, you know, what they should be doing. They're a company. That's what they're there in business to do. But in terms of spurring affordable housing, we've asked this question for a very long time, what does it take to really be able to ensure that that affordable housing happens if there are trade-offs such as the ones we're observing in this deal?
Right. I mean, there is nothing wrong with developers making a profit. They wouldn't be here to build housing if they didn't. And in fact, if you make the requirements on affordable housing too onerous, you end up with no one actually building the units. And so it's a matter of finding that appropriate balance, finding that sweet spot where you're able to benefit the community while still making the deals lucrative enough for developers so that they'll build and provide us with the units that we need.
In this case, though, it doesn't seem like those units are being provided, so it seems to be kind of a moot point.
Yeah, that's one of the really frustrating things about this particular project. This is, I believe, the first transit-oriented development project for residential to come up for permitting. And with one of the most important goals of transit-oriented development being building affordable housing, to have the first project call for zero units to be built is really troubling.
And there are those who would have said that maybe that should have been where it stopped right there without having any affordable units built, that the project should not have been allowed to go forward. Is that how you feel?
No, I think, you know, that there is the potential for this project to benefit the community, but it's just a matter of, you know, this is a process. And it's just a matter of finding the appropriate balance in this process. So, you know, one of the things that we would love to see is that there is actually an agreement or a requirement to build affordable housing, whether it's in this particular complex or someplace close to the rail but off-site. You know, that would be the ideal. Whether providing cash in lieu so that affordable housing can be built elsewhere at another time, that may be acceptable. But the real ideal is building affordable housing units now. And that's still a possibility, and we hope it to be the outcome in this case.
All right. So what I hear you saying is that it would be okay to have an affordable housing offset off-site. Thanks very much, Gavin. We'll talk to you shortly.
Thanks so much, Beth Ann. Appreciate it.
Gavin Thornton is the co-executive director of the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. It's part of a network of 17 nonprofit public interest justice centers in the U.S. and Mexico. And now two stories that have been underreported, even with the media saturation of the presidential race. President Obama meets with the leaders of China, Russia, and Turkey, but skips the Philippines. An ominous election in Germany and new regulations on one of the Big Island's major tourist attractions. Those are just some of what's percolating through the mind of news analyst Neil Conan, who joins us most Tuesdays from his MacNut farm on the Big Island. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So given the volume of coverage, it's kind of hard to believe that any story involving Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton manages to sneak below the radar, and you have too.
Well, both of these have been reported, but they have not gotten the attention that, for example, Donald Trump's position on immigration does, whatever that might be this hour. One is a story that came out last spring. We learned that the Donald Trump Foundation, not the Clinton Foundation, the Donald Trump Foundation, have made an illegal donation to the reelection campaign of Florida's attorney general, a woman named Pam Bondi.
So that's the Trump University story.
Yes, exactly, yeah. The attorney general's office was thinking about joining the civil suit that had been filed by the state of New York. That argues that Trump University defrauded its students. It's the case. Anyway, while all this was going on, Attorney General Bondi solicited Donald Trump personally for a campaign contribution. He agreed. She then announced that Florida would not join the lawsuit. And mysteriously, just 4 days later, a check arrives from the Trump Foundation for $25,000.
So that's kind of interesting timing.
Indeed. And supporters of Hillary Clinton have been angrily charging that if this was the Clinton Foundation that had made an illegal campaign contribution under such suspicious circumstances, there would be squadrons of reporters on the case. Last week, the Washington Post, to be fair, reported the Trump Foundation paid a fine to the IRS. Nonprofit foundations are not allowed to make political contributions. The Post also found out that the Trump Foundation did not report this contribution accurately to the IRS. All innocent bookkeeping mistakes, the foundation says, but a suspicious mind might see an attempt to cover up an illegal campaign contribution. As you may have noticed, there are plenty of suspicious minds on social media, so this is all over the internet, but very little coverage and very little follow-up on TV and in the major newspapers, except, again, for the Washington Post.
Okay, so that's one story. What about the other one?
The other one, this baffles me even more. Now, to be fair, this did make headlines for a day, but quickly dropped out of sight amid the avalanche of news that followed Donald Trump's visit to Mexico. This is Hillary Clinton's speech on Donald Trump and the alt-right. That's the loose collection of white nationalists and anti-government groups. She made a speech that absolutely eviscerated both Trump and his new campaign chairman, Steve Bannon, whose day job is to run Breitbart, the so-called news website that champions the alt-right. Now, in this speech, Clinton used effectively, as the most effective tactic against Donald Trump and Breitbart, is to use their own words. And she, like a prosecutor, convicted them in a closing statement of, being seriously dangerous. This is not merely conservatism. It's not republicanism. It is something else. And now in Europe, you hear a lot about, there's right-wing parties and there are dirty right-wing parties. Mm-hmm. Sort of the difference between Nicolas Sarkozy in France and Marianne Le Pen. Mm-hmm. Now, this made the case that Donald Trump has taken over the Republican Party on behalf of the dirty right, and it's frightening.
You mentioned right-wing politics in Europe. You mentioned just a moment ago, just the other day, in Germany, another country where immigration is a major issue, a far-right party did surprisingly well in a local election. What do you make of that?
This is ominous. The Alternative for Germany party finished second in the state called Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. This is the home territory for Chancellor Angela Merkel in what used to be East Germany. Her conservative party finished third. So this is a major embarrassment and a very bad sign for her in the run-up to national elections next year. Now, last year, Germany took in 1 million refugees, mostly from Syria. There was an initial surge of compassion, but that has soured very much. And by way of comparison, there's been a lot of hysteria, again, mostly from Donald Trump, in the United States, which took in 10,000 Syrian refugees this year.
the Syrian refugees, though, keep coming because the war in Syria continues.
Sadly, the ceasefire that never really was has completely unraveled. The fighting and the bombing is as intense as ever. And to complicate things even more, Turkey sent troops over the border last week to attack both ISIS and some Kurdish groups that it doesn't like, but which are allies of the United States.
As you and I have talked about, U.S. relations with Turkey have plummeted after that failed coup.
Yeah, President Erdogan blames the coup on an elderly cleric who lives in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. And by extension, Erdogan also blames the United States.
President Obama, though, met with Erdogan just the other day at the G20 summit in China. Did they sort of kind of patch things up?
Sort of kind of, but, you know, a great deal is going to depend on what happens with this cleric. Turkey wants the U.S. to extradite him to face charges. They want him extradited yesterday. The U.S. says this is a process. It has to go through channels, and we'll have to await the usual procedures. And so Turkey is waiting impatiently.
Obama also met with Vladimir Putin to talk about a new ceasefire. How did that go?
That got nowhere, exactly. There is such distrust now between Russia and the United States. You know, it's hard to see how they could reach an agreement, or at least an agreement that would hold. Their interests are so different in Syria, and, you know, the distrust. Look at another subject on the table there in that meeting between Obama and Putin. It was hacking and the strong suspicion that Russia is trying to interfere with the U.S. presidential election, hacking the Democratic National Committee, for example.
Now, while the president met with Putin and Erdogan and Chinese President Xi Jinping, there was one appointment that President Obama simply canceled. We know which one that is.
With Rodrigo Duterte, the new president of the Philippines. Now, they were supposed to meet in Laos on the sidelines of a meeting of Southeast Asian leaders. Obama went there after the meeting in China. And there's a lot to talk about. The Philippines is on the front lines of a confrontation with China in the South China Sea, and there's a major human rights story that we've talked about. Duterte was elected just a little over 2 months ago. Since then, Philippine police and vigilante groups have murdered some 2,000 people, most of them shot execution style. Now, these are always identified as drug suspects, and Duterte indignantly rejects any criticism as meddling with Philippine sovereignty. On his way to Laos, he said he would not listen to any questions from President Obama on this, and he called Obama a nasty name. Now, exactly how nasty depends on your translation, which you prefer, but nasty enough for the president to conclude that a meeting with Duterte, who he called obviously a very colorful fellow, that a meeting with him right now might not be.
So many layers to that word, colorful. Now, Duterte apologized, though.
Sort of. A statement that he was sorry the insult had come out as a personal attack.
Now, one thing before we let you go, considerably closer to home, very quickly, is how the Hawaii is about to propose new rules to regulate manta ray viewing there on the Big Island. What's happening?
The proposed regulations were supposed to come out over the weekend at a meeting in Kona, but that was postponed due to Hurricane Lester, which, of course, didn't show up. This is a big deal here. Maybe about 24 boats go out every night. It's far and away the most important part of their business. It's a major attraction for scuba divers and snorkelers. You always see the manta ray trip as one of the top dives in the world in scuba magazines. I've done it. It is both amazing and it's a circus. And I think even the operators, at least some of them, have come to realize that they've got to dial this down.
All right. So more for our future agenda. Thanks very much, Neil. Talk to you next week. We got to go.
Okay. You bet, Bethann.
Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Dr. Greg Sakamoto is a dermatologist at Queens Medical Center. He's the recipient of many scholarships. It was clear right from the start of our discussion that he's very grateful for the support he's received. These scholarships enabled him to attend the John Burns Medical School and then Harvard, and it changed his life. He went into dermatology to restore patients' health and overcome the stigma that affects those with severe skin problems. People with disfigurements often withdraw from the public because others stare at them and make them feel uncomfortable. They become reclusive. Dr. Sakamoto helps return these people to the world after being shut away, sometimes for years. He doesn't consider the impact of money on his work. If a patient can't afford it, he treats them anyway, and on Wednesday afternoon, he's at the medical school working with his students. As if this were not enough already, he serves as an ambassador to the Hawaii Community Foundation, where he reviews thousands of grant applications the foundation receives each year. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
For today's quiz, we ask you to name an American born in the Kingdom of Hawaii who went on to become a mentor to African-American activist Booker T. Washington. Although an expat at birth, our man returned to New England to attend college after graduating from Punahou. During the Civil War, he rose to the rank of Brigadier General, commanded the 8th U.S. Colored Troop Regiment, and after the war, he established the Colored Hampton Institute. There he met and became a mentor to Booker T. Washington, whom he called one of his brightest students. In fact, it was on the mentor's recommendation that Booker T. Washington was made the first leader of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And his mentor, Brigadier General Samuel Chapman Armstrong. That's today's answer.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The high-level meetings at the World Conservation Congress are now over. The gathering of IUCN members continues throughout this week. And as we've been doing since the Congress began, we're checking in at the hashtag Nature for All Pavilion, which will stay open all week, as will all the pavilions in the exhibition hall. Today, Chloe Dragon-Smith, who works for Canadian Parks, joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, as the energy has somewhat shifted with the high-level meetings over, how are members shifting into the next phase of what's going to happen this week?
Well, actually, today is Students' Day, so I'm surrounded by a bunch of students running around and going to check out the pavilion. So the transition it's kind of nice. It's like passing it on to the next generation.
And a lot of energy, I can imagine, if you've got kids running all over the place.
Oh, yeah, it's humming out there.
You work with a lot of people within the Canadian park system and trying to connect people to nature and a new generation, which is what today is all about with Students' Day. What is it you think they're most able to connect to in ways that perhaps their parents aren't?
I think that we are obviously living in a different time, and something that we like to talk about a lot is how to connect young people using technology. So using technology as a bridge rather than a hindrance. So that's something we've been experimenting a lot with here at the Congress. We've had some virtual realities from Google piloted, which has been really exciting. We're doing a lot of video work and different things with filming art and music. So trying to access nature from a couple of different dimensions, I think, is the biggest thing.
But your bottom line is nothing supplants the real deal.
I think we are all working towards getting out into nature as an end goal, but we're just recognizing that there's a lot of different ways to do that. Yeah.
And for people who may be...
What works for somebody might not be what works for somebody else, and we need to have room for that.
So that people who may be in major metropolitan areas where getting out into some of the nature that is available clearly online and clearly through other virtual means may be the only way they can access it, and that we shouldn't turn our nose up at that.
For sure, yeah. And there's a lot of studies out there now that are starting to show even the benefits of having, for instance, a screensaver that has nature on it, or looking at a picture of nature, or even just looking at nature out of a window can still affect your health and well-being.
Particularly when you don't have any windows, seeing it on your screen may be the only window you've got. Thanks very much,
yeah.
Chloe, and have fun with the kids today in the pavilion.
Thank you very much.
Chloe Dragon-Smith is a young Indigenous woman from Canada's North. She works with Canadian Parks, co-chairing the intergenerational working group called Connecting a New Generation with Nature. Together, the group developed a product called the Nature Playbook. We'll be reconnecting with hashtag Nature for All as the week goes on.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Demystifying the Kuahu, a conversation with Maui Kumuhula about what the Kuahu means to them. 7:30 p.m. this Thursday in McCoy Studio Theater, mauiarts.org.
Beth Ann, I was really struck by the comparison and the similarities between getting along in the simulation of Mars's atmosphere in a very confined space and getting along on planet Earth with all the incidences being brought up by IUCN. It's like the two, here you got six people, they can't leave, and here we got 6 billion and we can't leave.
I like that comparison, and we're going to leave it at that and give us something to think about. Now, tomorrow, we're going to talk about some things which have already left or which are in danger of leaving. We're going to take a look at the IUCN Red List of ecosystems and also species, and look at what comes next. So we've got the list. Now what?
Plus, we also sit down with 88-year-old Win Straub, who's enjoying the ride and just starting the rest of his life.
Oh, boy. Now, we like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like to leave us your comments. Our number is 808-792-8217. Please be sure to leave us your full name and your phone number. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or you want to pass one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation or HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.